You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Historian David Petrucha is my guest. He's written many fine books, including a few about baseball. His history books include Too Long Ago, A Childhood Memory, A Vanished World, T.R.'s Last War, Theodore Roosevelt, The Great War, and A Journey of Triumph and Tragedy, 1932, The Rise of Hitler and FDR, Two Tales of Politics, Betrayal and Unlikely Destiny, 1960, LBJ versus JFK versus Nixon, The Epic Campaign That Forged Three Presidencies. That's a fantastic book. He wrote a book about the gangster Rothstein, the life, times, and murder of the criminal genius who fixed the 1919 World Series. And his latest book, The Mammoth Roosevelt Sweeps Nation, FDR's 1936 Landslide and the Triumph of the Liberal Ideal, to name just a few books. David Petrucha, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Glad to be on.
How do you go about producing a history like this one, Roosevelt Sweeps Nation? I mean, I call it mammoth, but I don't want people to get the idea that it's too big to read. It's a page-turner, although it is exhaustively researched, obviously. So how do you approach this kind of a thing?
First off, with an idea. And, you know, I've been doing these presidential histories now for a while. That's been the bulk of my work. And so you pick one out and you think, is this going to work or not work? And some you may pitch an idea to your agent and he's like, I don't think so. Or or maybe you've pitched it to around to the publishing houses and they go, well, we can give you a 75-cent advance for that one. And you rethink it. And so this one was COVID related. If you don't like the book, blame COVID. Because I was sort of sitting around wondering what the next project would be and decided I would write this one totally on spec. No consultation with an agent, no consultation with a publishing house, and just do it, which actually was sort of freeing because it meant I had no deadline. But nonetheless, it came together very, very quickly. And the challenge was to do it without setting foot in a library because they were all closed. But the internet is a marvelous thing. All the resources which are now there, which in a way with I tend to rely a lot on the daily press of the time. And so much now is online. And then you go and you see what is online when you start the project or when you're in the middle of the project. And 6 months later, you say, well, I didn't see that back then. Ooh. So stuff is coming together all the time. And it can be like too much candy. So you've got to know, when to cut it off. Once upon a time, I went to hear a publisher speak at a local college or an author. And she was talking about how she had switched over from nonfiction to fiction. And then she was talking about how she was writing nonfiction before that. And a friend of hers who she had asked for advice said, had said, your research is showing. That was not a compliment. That was like in days of yore, your slip is showing, ma'am. And when your research shows, when it becomes intrusive, you've gone too far. So you've got to keep things flowing. You've got to provide details. Being the old baseball guy that I am, I remember starting out with the 1960s Mets and Bob Murphy. Bob Murphy coming in here to paint the word picture for you. So if you can paint the word picture accurately and not make it up, don't say, you know, what somebody was thinking on a train ride at 3:42 in the afternoon. Okay. Don't make up details. But if you can put some actual color into it and bring life to the story, so as some people say, your books read like a novel, then so much the better, because I found over the years that people actually will tell you, I hate history.
Right.
And I don't get, I've never understood that, obviously, because I've always loved history. But a lot of people do. And I guess a bunch of people must write it very badly.
but I also think that people have a natural, there are people who do math and science, that wouldn't be me. And then there are people who do history and literature, and that would be
me. Oh yeah, the brain tunes out. The brain tunes out.
But history, I mean, I think the one thing we have always heard about history is that those who don't learn it will be condemned to repeat it, and so on. And I think that your books have a lot to say about our current political situation. I was reading about this guy, this Pennsylvania State Senate, Doug Mastriano.
Mastriani, I think.
Yeah, he's the GOP candidate for governor. And he said that there was no room in his movement for Jews, that this is an explicitly Christian movement, because this is an explicitly Christian country. We don't want people who are atheists. We don't want people who are Jewish. And we don't people who are non-believers, agnostic or whatever. He said, you're free to stay here, right? You're not going to be forced to convert or anything, but you're going to enjoy the fruits of living in a Christian society under Christian laws. Now, he didn't say this in 1936. He said it in 2022. And it sounded a lot like one of the characters, at least in Roosevelt Sweeps Nation.
Yeah, it's not always an undercurrent of anti-Semitism going on back then. And remember, probably in the 1930s, Jews were excluded from hotels and lodgings. Certainly blacks were in New York City. And it's interesting to see what sort of dance still goes on, even in a less tolerant time. The great Jew baiter of that time, in America, Father Charles Coughlin, does not come into that position all at once. He's, you know, the first time I come across him nationally when he's talking about Jews, he's saying, oh no, don't blame them for everything. That's just wrong, wrong, wrong. But then he's got Jews on the brain, and he keeps bringing it up. And then by the time you get into advent of World War II, he's reprinting stuff from the German Nazi press. So it's really, and then you even see an anti-Semitic response from Franklin Roosevelt, who is accused, if that is the right word, or suggested by former governor of Michigan that he's Rosenfeld or something like that. He's descended from Jews, which was a common slander against him.
Well, that's the thing that struck me about 1936 is that, you know, today people, I'm sure there are just as many racist people today as there ever were. I think racism is alive and well, but people are slightly more sensitive about expressing their racism. Until recently, I think in the last few years, we've seen a rise in the willingness to express racist sentiment, to, you know, carry Confederate flags into the Capitol and so forth. But in 1936, people were just brazenly racist. That's because that was just kind of, most people were. So nobody thought it was anything offensive when people declared their white supremacy.
Well, certainly there was segregation at the time. I think it's in 1936 or maybe the year before, where Franklin Roosevelt goes south and is talking about, you know, the praise of whatever Confederate monument he was dedicating. But his support came. This is, you know, one of the things in my books is, do not think that there's a straight line in history between left or right or regions, so that it's like, oh, well, the prohibition must be like a right wing thing. It's progressive. Women's suffrage must be the Democratic Party, right? No. In fact, most of the support is coming out of the Republican Party, in part because of the South, because of, and also because of the immigrant population where they come, the immigrants come from very traditional societies. And it's like, well, we don't know about this. His support and or regions where the different regions of the country, I think we're more aware of that, where the South was once Democratic, but also where the Northeast in 1932 in the 30s is much more conservative than the supposedly conservative Midwest or the Rocky Mountain states. You take a look at a state maybe like Idaho or Montana, and you get some pretty North Dakota, some pretty radical people coming out of there. So it's a jumble, and just don't assume things, because you're going to be surprised reading all those newspapers and memoirs and things like that. I just came across an interesting factoid the other day. Merrick Garland. It's like his grandfather-in-law was Sam Rosenman, Roosevelt's big shot speech writer. And Sam Rosenman, we find as a Supreme Court judge in New York City in 1936, issues an injunction against picketing by blacks who are trying to force, shall we say, the store owners in Harlem to actually hire blacks to work behind the counters, which was a major grievance in the 30s. So again, quite the surprise with Merrick Garland, but it was quite the surprise reading that in preparing the book to see an injunction like that in New York State, supposedly liberal, tolerant New York State, and that it was issued by a very close confidant of Franklin Roosevelt.
Interesting. Well, so do you think that we will ever see, you've written about several elections like this one in which the whole country finally just gets behind a candidate and then gets behind the president. I mean, I don't think President Roosevelt ever had, he had the support of, unprecedented the support he had, obviously, because he was elected four times. But do you think that a candidate for president today could ever have that kind of large support because of the divisions in our country today?
The 19th century, the post-Civil War, you know, if you just look at the presidents at that time, it's like, hey, most of these guys are Republican. So this is a solidly Republican era. And it's not. In many cases, like with Trump or George Bush, W. Bush, you see Republicans being elected without popular majorities. Rutherford B. Hayes or Benjamin Harrison, and that the Congress is often Democratic or split very, very evenly. And then you get this big Republican ascendancy, followed by the Democratic ascendancy for quite a while. And then Eisenhower comes back and is, you know, everybody likes Ike in the 50s. So planning these things or predicting these things, even short term, not long term. One of the things I developed as a motto to say when I was involved in baseball, and they'd say, "So who's going to win the World Series?" It's like, I'm a historian, not a prophet. So I mean, you could see a big blowout again with the public. You might not like the way the blowout is coming, but it could very well end up where the deadlock suddenly shifts. And the deadlock could shift because the beliefs of one or both parties shift. And so, you know, you might see the big Republican shift, which I'm not convinced of in the midterms. I'm just not. And that takes me back to my 1948 election book, where as the election is coming to a close and it's supposed to be Dewey, Thomas Dewey, and no one's going to vote for this Truman guy. And they're saying, well, you know, Massachusetts doesn't look too good here. And the Midwest, the farmers are all, they don't like this farm price thing. And in Minnesota, Humphrey, watch it. Humphrey's going to beat Joe Ball, and he would be the first Democrat. And they said, but don't worry. because Dewey's got it in the bag. And you're seeing similar things with a lot of the polling in the Senate races in the United States right now, where I don't see a red wave in the Senate.
But you're a historian, not a
prophet. But I'm just not seeing it, you know. But you know, it's July.
That's right.
And these things, that's another thing, these things shift.
They don't print World Series tickets in July.
No. And so in 1936, it's like, well, we know 1936 is just a blowout, and it's always going to be a blowout, and everyone knew that. And it's like, you know, why are you wasting your time either writing or reading this book? Well, it's not just the Literary Digest which gets it wrong. You get a bunch of prominent Democrats who are saying, you know, this Roosevelt, he's just blowing it. He's off yachting. He's off on this boat in the North Atlantic. It's like, shape up, put a campaign together, fight back. And the poll numbers are not good. And the big Gallup poll, which is the one which everyone says, well, they got it right, and the Literary Digest got it so spectacularly wrong. In the middle of the year, he has Alf Landon up ahead, not in the popular vote, but in the Electoral College. And he's saying, this is going to be one of the closest elections in our history. So people get it wrong. Even a lot of Roosevelt supporters are worried in the middle of time. So again, July, it's a long, long time from May to December, as that's the old song goes. Yeah. September song.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with David Petruzza, an award-winning historian whose books include 1920, The Year of Six Presidents, Rothstein, The Lifetimes and Murder of the Criminal Genius Who Fixed the 1919 World Series, 1948, Harry Truman's Improbable Victory in the Year That Transformed America's Role in the World, and 1960, LBJ versus JFK versus Nixon, the epic campaign that forged three presidencies. His new book is called Roosevelt Sweeps Nation, FDR's 1936 Landslide and the Triumph of the Liberal Ideal.
David Petruzza, the thing that strikes me about your new book, Roosevelt Sweeps Nation, FDR's 1936 Landslide and the Triumph of the Liberal Ideal, from the very beginning of the book, I mean, we all know that FDR was a president for 12 years, that he was a monument of presidential presidency. But this book really gives you the idea that it was an unsteady, would he be reelected even once? And it's kind of great to go.
Well, the economy dips down. You know, there is a real Roosevelt boom when he takes office. A large part of that, I think, is regaining confidence in the banking system, which was amazingly easy to do. You have it sort of a two-step process. One, you have the bank holiday, and he is this master politician, where Hoover was talking about doing this, but Hoover is like, well, we should have a bank moratorium. Well, moratorium is like, that's a 10-cent word, but it doesn't inspire people. But Roosevelt, we have a bank holiday. You know, you're not going to be able to go to the bank and get your money out, folks. Okay. Which normally would scare the hell out of people. But Roosevelt says, and we'll have a bank holiday. And everyone goes, oh, that's great. And then they also go in like hell and see which banks are solvent and which banks are not. Interesting fact that I don't think is in the book, which I came across, is, well, what percentage of deposits were actually lost in all these bank failures? It was only about 3%. But it doesn't take a lot to scare the hell out of people. You know, when a certain number of banks, and a lot of the banks which went under were very small, undercapitalized things. And also some highly placed ones in New York City, which actually Franklin Roosevelt should have done more to oversee when he was governor. But the other thing which is done, which is, again, a very simple idea and which had been around since William Jennings Bryan, but then again, no one ever paid any attention to anything from William Jennings Bryan said, was a federal deposit insurance, where the feds would say, okay, we'll insure, you know, your deposit up to, what is it now, $250,000 per bank or something. And that really stopped the runs on the bank, because people no longer had to worry about that. And if they, once they did that, the money started to flow back into the banks from under the mattresses, from in the tin cans in the backyard. And then the banks could loan, and the economy, you know, shoots up in a way just from that, aside from anything else Roosevelt does. But then there's a downturn, because economies go up and down all the time, boys and girls. And so it's heading down again in like late 35 and 36. And in early 35, you know, Literary Digest is asking, so, folks, what do you think of this New Deal? And it's like an amazing percentage love it. And then at the beginning of 36, it's like, we're not too sure. We're not too sure. And that's because, you know, they had done some things which didn't work. The National Recovery Act did not work and was struck down by the Supreme Court. The Agricultural Adjustment Act was not popular, and that got struck down. And in a way, they did Roosevelt a favor, because they took those things off the boards for discussion, and they got them out of the way. And Roosevelt privately, I think, said to Francis Perkins, look, we'll just write a history of these acts and let it go and not fight it. It was just as well that they're gone, because he was, you know, if something doesn't work, let's try something new. And so he was always trying something new. And then, of course, the other factor is, does the party blow apart? Right now, we seem to see both parties on the verge of blowing up real good, as they used to say on Second City TV. And back then, you have Roosevelt facing challenges on the right from the Democratic Party, from the American Liberty League. And, you know, you had two former nominees of the Democratic Party recently. We're not talking Grover Cleveland or Tilden. We're talking Al Smith from 28 and John W. Davis in 1924. The previous two nominees are turn on him and say, no, this New Deal is going too far. It's not good for the country. It's extra constitutional. And that's on the right. And you've got the DuPonts and the General Motors people backing this. And it seems to be like something which is going to have some traction. It really doesn't. But then you've got the populist radicals, the Huey Longs, who was assassinated in 1935, the father Coughlins. Both Long and Coughlin had been, all these people had been for Roosevelt in 32. Some more enthusiastically than others. Coughlin just thought he was like the second coming of Christ, just about, and almost says that, you know, in a blasphemous way. And so he and Huey Long and people like that are turning on Roosevelt. And also Roosevelt, this is the year he puts forward Social Security. And Social Security is, well, you think, well, that's a no-brainer for the New Deal. Well, he fights it. He fights it, and he fights Bob Wagner at first. He says, no, that's not the priority. The priority is unemployment insurance. We're not going to do this. But then out of California, we get the Townsend Plan, Southern California. And that's for $200 a month, which doesn't sound like much now, but was like big bucks then. For everyone over what 65 or so in America, with the proviso that they not work, and the further proviso that they spend it all. I don't know how you were going to monitor that, you know, but that's one of the reasons why the plan was unbalanced. And the idea was that this would do two things: would take care of the old folks, but it would also be, shall we say, pump priming for the economy. Roosevelt says this plan is dangerous. This is inflationary. It's going to wreck the economy. Let's not do that. And that's when he puts Social Security forward with actually just about everyone's support. Most of the votes in Congress against it do not come from conservatives. And there are very few votes which are against it, but are people like Vito Marcantonio, who is a radical in East Harlem, and the fellows up there in North Dakota, like Bill Lemke, who are really Huey Long type, Father Coughlin radicals. And what they eventually do, even with Huey Long dead, a moldering in his grave, is they form a third party. And this third party is not going to win. But what do third parties, what their game is always to muck things up. And you muck things up and you pull a bunch of states away from Roosevelt. And maybe you throw it into the Electoral College, or maybe you even throw the Electoral College into the Landon camp. But the person they nominate is no Huey Long, is Bill Lemke, who was pretty damn dull. And then you get Father Coughlin ramping up his proto-fascist remarks right during the campaign. And the same thing going on with Huey Long's protege, a very charismatic former minister named Gerald L.K. Smith, really quite the orator. And he starts in October. He goes to New York and says, we're gonna form this 10 million man army or something, and we're gonna basically overthrow the government. And Townsend, who he'd become very close with, says, get out. We want no part of this. Townsend was radical in some ways economically, but actually pretty conservative otherwise. But this party folds, but it had the potential at one time to scare the hell out of the Democrats. And Huey Long's original idea was, I'm not going to win in 36, but I'm going to elect a Republican in 36. And they will mess up the country so bad that I will win in 1940. But of course, he's assassinated in the Louisiana state capitol in 35.
And now his plan was to give $1,000 to everybody, or something like
that. I forget what the amount was. The details were inconsequential. Uh-huh. It was going to share the wealth. And again, this was one of these things where all the economists said, there's no way the numbers work on this. But and what he was going to do was shave the top off of basically everyone's income. And I think, there's income taxes and there's wealth taxes. And his plan was basically a combination of both, where you would have a cap on how much you would have. And there's a wonderful speech on YouTube where he appears drunk, as he often does. but as one of his observers says, he was drunk on himself. So it was difficult to tell when he was plastered and when he was just enthused about things. But talking about how you were going to bring everyone back from the barbecue. The Mellons and the Morgans and the Baruchs and all these people, and take the money that they don't need because they've got 60 suits and they don't need all those things. And you people are out there and you're naked and hungry and all this, and you'll get a radio, you'll get a car, you'll get this. Some observers have said, however, that not only was it economically unsound, but it was real malarkey, because if you take a look at what he did in Louisiana, aside from taxing Standard Oil and, building a bunch of roads, and bridges, which were badly needed, giving out free school books, which are hardly radical ideas, that in terms of sharing the wealth, this was never done in Louisiana. So it's like, and certainly he had the votes, because if he didn't get the votes, he'd just pick you over the head and make you vote his way.
Who assassinated him?
A guy named Seymour Weiss, a doctor. And his father-in-law, a Judge Pavey, was going to be redistricted by Long. And that's why Long had called a special session of the Louisiana legislature. I know what you're saying. He was a U.S. senator. He wasn't the governor anymore. Well, that was a small detail, because he did whatever he wanted. He was basically still the dictator of Louisiana. And actually, at one point, there was a martial law declared in New Orleans where he was fighting the old line governor there. And people were ringing the streets with sandbags and machine guns and calling up one bunch of troops or another. It was pretty ugly back then. But Long was going to redistrict Judge Pavey out of his job. And they were also spreading rumors. And Long was, by all accounts, was actually a very non-racist Southern demagogue. This was not part of his agenda, but he seemed to be ramping up against Judge Pavey and was going to spread rumors that his family contained what they euphemistically called coffee blood. And so that this was one of the things which upset Long's assassin. And one of the things which people say about the assassination is that it wasn't the assassination that killed him. It's like one of those murder mysteries where you found out that, he wasn't killed by being shot. He had had a heart attack 5 minutes before, or some gimmick like that in the cheap movie or novel, that the Long's bodyguards shot the assassin to pieces. They just kept plugging lead into him. Bang, 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 bang. And these shots in a marble hallway ricocheted off. And actually, it was those shots, the ricochets, which killed Long, you know. And of course, it was sepsis back then. It was infection. Right. It wasn't necessarily the being shot. It was that the, you know, they didn't have penicillin and people could, you know, just die. So, and Roosevelt had almost been assassinated in 1932 and was he was saved by basically that his assassin was so short couldn't reach up and get a clear shot. I think someone jostled him or something and killed the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Cermak. Well, which is another conspiracy theory. Oh yeah. No, it wasn't against Anguera, it was the mob. It's always the mob, you know.
Well, David Patricia, there's so much to talk about in your book, but I want to ask about another echo of 2022, which is the Supreme Court. I know that Roosevelt was he contemplated or attempted to stack the court. It didn't work. What are you, as you're not a prognosticator but a historian, but looking at the Supreme Court today, do you think there's a precedent for doing anything about it?
It's hard. I mean, it's not constitutional. There's nothing magical in the Constitution that says nine, and in fact originally it wasn't nine, but it's been nine for so long that it's part of the fabric of our society. And to do that, you'd have to get 60 senators on board unless you somehow break the filibuster beforehand. So it would be very hard to do. And I think it would be very controversial. And then you get into, it's sort of like raising the minimum wage. You do it once, but then you have to do it again. It's like Chinese food. You have to eat it a couple hours later. Am I allowed to say that in today's world?
I think Chinese food is not a racist.
Okay. The Democrats have 11, and then the Republicans get back in and they have 13, and then they have 15. So, you know, what's the end point of this game? Isn't it probably better to just play it play by the existing rules, which was the opinion in, as popular as Roosevelt was, once he proposed that following. That's another lesson, boys and girls. Don't let a big victory go to your head. Don't think you can just, you know, that people love you. I ran and won for alderman once and was the first member of my party to win in 65 years. And I had to ask myself afterwards, did I win or did the other guy lose? You should always ask yourself if the other guy lost. And your popularity has limits. And Roosevelt's popularity hit the wall with packing the Supreme Court. And also there was another recession going on at that time. So the combination of bad economic times and the very idea of tinkering with the court caused the problem. The other thing which happened is that he scared the hell out of the court, so that he found that some of the decisions started to go his way, particularly the votes by Charles Evans Hughes, the Chief Justice. And then you saw a couple of the conservatives resign. So FDR gets to appoint a bunch of liberal justices, including a guy named Hugo Black, who was a big congressional ally of his, former senator and former member of the Ku Klux Klan. Again, expect surprises in our history. Expect surprises.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are talking this week with historian David Petruja. His new book is Roosevelt Sweeps Nation, FDR's 1936 Landslide, and the Triumph of the Liberal Ideal.
Well, I would just, if you don't mind, I want to talk a little bit about baseball as well, because I know you're a baseball historian.
Okay.
I'm not surprised that you are both a historian and a baseball historian, because when I first got interested in baseball, I went to a bookstore to get some look at the sports section, and there were, you know, a few books about football, and there were a few books about basketball, and there were quite a few books about golf, and then there were 14 shelves of books about baseball. Baseball seems to be the most intellectual sport.
Yeah, and the most historical. It looks backward more to its history more than the other sports. And, all the way back. And the, you know, the events at Cooperstown, which just transpired, and the people. One of the ways is, I think, because you can track so much of baseball. You can track every pitch. I mean, you can't easily track who's running up and down the court at any given moment, or, you know, coming too near to the end zone, or wasn't in the right position to catch the pass. But baseball, you could do that more easily than with the other sports. So you can track these things, but also just the history of things and the cities and the colorful characters, and the fact that it was being written about so early. One of the things which I think inspired me, well, I was trained to write history. I got 2 degrees in history, loved it from the beginning, loved it even before I loved baseball. Is there was a great 2-volume, or they'd become a 3-volume set of baseball history by a guy named Harold Seymour. And he treated it with, he was an academic. So he wrote something which was very scholarly, not dull. And it showed me that I could do, or somebody could do, similar books on baseball. So a lot of my early books, actually all my early books, were baseball related. And then I got back to, I was sort of like Roy Hobbs in reverse. I went, you've been away from the game for a while. Yeah. So I was away from the historical game for a while. You know, life intervenes when you graduate from college. You have to, what's the words? Make a living. and then you end up, and then if you're lucky, you get back to what you had planned to do. So first came the baseball history and managing the baseball encyclopedia, which was pretty interesting. And then finally stumbling back into history with my biography of Arnold Rothstein. Which I did, the fellow who
fit, baseball, of course.
Who fixed the 1919 World Series, and that's what the subtitle of the book is. But that's not what I meant to write. I meant to write about a book about New York City in the 1920s. And he was just had a finger in every pie: politics, stock market, drug dealing, bootlegging, labor racketeering, Broadway. Financing shows, financing theaters. I mean, just amazing. And so that book then was like, so then you write a book and it's fairly successful. And they say, what do you want to do next? And it's like, what about this 1920 election? And then I was off to the races on doing that, because I've always been interested in politics and history. and really the presidents. So you can touch on them, but even with 1936, it's the backstory, and studying the presidents is a roadmap to studying the general history of America. Because you know, if you just think history of America all at once, it's just too big to swallow. But the presidencies put it down into digestible bites, except for FDR, of course, which is the whole buffet.
Well, I guess if you wrote about 1920, then you encountered FDR right there.
That's right. You can't get away. I can't get away from the Roosevelts. And what I found amazingly is that doing my books, 1920, 1932, 1936, now 1948, 1960, there's one character who shows up at certainly more than a footnote in all of them. And that's Eleanor. Mm-hmm. Eleanor's a player in all of them, even to like, you know, in 1960, like, I really don't like this Kennedy fellow. Huh. Adlai, can you do it again? actually, no. But she's there and she's at the convention. She gets off the plane and she's carrying her bags from the plane right into it. You need help? Nope, I'm fine. Eleanor.
In your 1960 book, one of the things that struck me was that all of the things that everybody knows about 1960, none of those things are actually true. and there were so many things about, we think of President Kennedy as being the good guy because he won, and we think of President Nixon as being the bad guy because he eventually was a bad guy. But when you think that Nixon did not call into question he was the vice president who certified the electoral votes in 1960, didn't he? He didn't say.
Right. I mean, he could have caused trouble in Illinois. And there were rumblings of a stolen election in Illinois even before the votes were counted, before they were cast. And the reason is because the Daley machine was trying to beat a state's attorney candidate who they did not like. And state's attorneys can cause big trouble for corrupt machines. So the idea was to steal the election if you had to from him. And if you stole the presidency as part of the bargain, well, so much the better. But Nixon held back on that. And, Kennedy is so young, so youthful, so vibrant. Well, Nixon is barely much older than him. He's a young whippersnapper too. So he's not like, you know, somebody saying now the rules are off. Nobody knows when to quit then now, but back then it's like, well, you know, I can wait and I'll run for governor of California and I'll win that in 62. And then I'll come back in 64 and then I'll be president. And well, he doesn't win in 62. He's not a factor in 64, but he keeps working at it. And, you know, in 68, he squeaks in, not particularly well. I was around back then and he ran a real stinko campaign at the end. It was a real Tom Dewey sort of campaign, and he damn near blew it to Hubert Humphrey. How bad was it, Johnny? Hubert Humphrey carried Texas.
Well, yeah. Well, there's another book there.
A lot of people have asked me to write that book. That's the most requested one.
1968.
Yeah, I won't do it. Not going to do it. Of course, I've said that before about books and I've done it.
So you're working on it and we can expect it soon. You know, David, Patricia, there's so much to talk about. It's been a wonderful conversation and I can't believe we ran out of time. Would you please come back and talk to me again?
Sure.
The new book is called Roosevelt Sweeps Nation, FDR's 1936 Landslide and the Triumph of the Liberal Ideal. David, Patricia, thank you so much for being my guest on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.